back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're on Radio Row. We used to do this thing on Sunday night to just get together, maybe get a couple of cocktails in a nice place because we're not golfers at all, but we would get together, we plug all these cables and wires and different stuff in, and Chris would sit down and tell us where everything was and tell us where all the parties were in town. And instead, Chris is back in Baltimore. Luke is in his palatial estate in Pennsylvania, and I am here in Los Angeles. And Chris, the topic of hiring and race in 2022, it will dominate what's going to happen here this week, right?
It will. And I think we spoke earlier about the type of change that's needed at the league level and the club level. And I think some of what Luke talked about in terms of getting more minority coaches and coaches of color in front of ownership groups and general managers does help. I think one of the things where even head coaches need to be better at is the route to become a head coach is through the coordinator positions. And the coordinator positions are not as diverse at the league level as they should be. And that's sort of the track that gets you to the head coach positions is being a coordinator. And each team has two or three of those. You know, remember John came through the special teams coordinator. So you have people in those positions. The other thing that having a coordinator, you know, that's a person of color, is the owner knows who you are more so than a general assistant coach. The owner may not talk to the running backs coach maybe once or twice a year in a meeting or out at training camp. But if you're the coordinator, chances are you're in a meeting with ownership on a little bit more regular basis. The owner gets to know who you are. And more importantly, when it comes time to hire and owner A calls owner B and says, tell me about your guy. Okay. Having him as a coordinator and someone who's leading players, who's doing some of the administrative work, the things that coaches have to deal with on and off the field with their players, there's a comfort level for the owners to be able to speak about their coordinators to help them move up the line. It helps general managers, it helps owners. So I think that there also has to be more diversity at the coordinator level and opportunities that will get them in the spotlight. Now, again, there's a great example in Eric Bieniemy, who is, you know, the Chiefs offense. We've seen what they've done, and he's had some opportunities. Now, Eric has had some issues a long time ago, but most everyone, including Andy Reid, his own head coach, they've been pushing him for opportunities, and he's interviewed with a couple of clubs. But that's one of those examples of someone who you think should be in a head coach role that hasn't happened. And that's really, really hard to explain. And I think the league is in a bit of a pickle here because you have people who have finally gotten tired of the lip service. They've gotten tired of those, you know, I don't want to call them sham interviews because I don't think that's fair to the men who are in those interviews, but certainly interviews where you walk in and you know you have about a 10% chance of getting the job. But you may do it for interview practice for the next time to learn something from doing it. So you come away with something. So I think the league is it has an issue here. Certainly their initial reaction to the Brian Flores lawsuit, the without merit within 2 hours.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to jump in because, yeah. I mean, you know, Moeller and I get sideways on PR and you know, and you are much more on that side than even the media side, although you've dealt with the media and obviously have an incredible understanding of that. But your side was the shit hit the fan and I have to write a press release and we have to strategize how we're going to have to deal with the television, radio people, the lawsuits, the lawyers, the aggrieved parties that are suing us or will be suing us. And you know, as well as anyone, right, you want to construct the narrative, right, Chris? You want to control the narrative, right? I mean, that's what this is all about, is controlling the narrative, right? So in order to control the narrative, you jump out and say, innocent, innocent, right? But 10 minutes later, boy, that was a really, really out of touch reaction from Park Avenue. Embarrassing, quite frankly.
Well, I think they thought that I don't know if they knew the Flores media blitz that was going to take place over the next 48 hours was coming. where Flores was on CNN. He was on ESPN. He was on several different media networks across, you know, every spectrum that you could think of.
But isn't that the case that the league just really believes, like, when you file a lawsuit, everyone sticks their head in the sand and says, I'll see you in court. I'll get my day in court. I'll have plenty to say in court. I know they told me to shut my mouth when I got sued, right? Like, so there's a shut your mouth part, and then there's a part where Flores and his group, they were playing offense. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I think they were very much playing offense. There were two sides or two fronts of that story. Certainly the minority coaches and how he was treated in interviews and the text messages between him and Bill Belichick are like 1A at the top. But the
and then the Giants released their press release that Bill Belichick doesn't speak for them, right? So
right. And then now you've got 1B, which is the allegation that there was some offer to lose games in order to improve their draft position, that there might have been an offer of additional money for him as a coach to basically tank. And considering the league's newfound religion with casinos and sports books, that 1B is a story that bears very close watch, because that speaks to the integrity of the game and the integrity of the owners. And quite honestly, if I'm on Park Avenue, part A of this, the Flores and the coaching part of it, those are things you can manage by forcing owners to do certain things and trying to make the inroads better for coaches of color. 1B is an integrity of the game issue that involves one of your 32 brethren. That's a much different thing. You can't control that. You can't put the genie back in the bottle if they have a way of proving that ownership wanted him to lose games intentionally. That's a horrible look for the league that has gotten a lot of money from casinos and sports books in the last 3 years.
Well, Chris, maybe this leads us right into Luke, because Luke, you've covered a pretty fake baseball team for 3 years that really hasn't come to post to compete, hasn't really tried to compete in any way to win games, right? So, you know, Vegas has been on the over-under for triple-digit losses for bad baseball teams. I know you and your whole family loves the Philadelphia 76ers. There's something to be said about that, this isn't a new concept, but it's a new concept for a coach saying, oh, well, I wasn't supposed to win. I mean, if you go talk to Sam Perlazzo right now, 15 years ago, he said, I wasn't supposed to win. They knew I wasn't going to win. We all sort of knew we couldn't win. Baseball is playing into that, and this is another part of sports radio here this week that nobody's talking about the baseball deal here, I guess, right? Like, but the baseball deal speaks to that, because the integrity of the situation's kind of gone out the window when players who are Major League Baseball players, in the same way that Brian Flores is an NFL head coach, Adley Rutschman, Grayson Rodriguez, start the clock. All of these issues speak to, are you really trying to win? And, you know, I guess we're into a point now where we could talk about the integrity of the draft and whether the draft should be legal in any of these sports. But more than that, the benefit of losing that, and you're the analytics guy here, Luke, the benefit of losing and what the long-term goal is for the growth mindset of all of this, right?
Yeah. One thing I wanted to add with the, as it pertains to the without merit part of the statement, that was a reflexive response. That was a reflex that you tend to, but isn't the whole, you know, the whole point of this argument is to change reflexes, right? For owners in terms of who they're hiring. But to get back to what you were just mentioning, I mean, rebuilding, tanking, all these different, I mean, these are not new concepts. I mean, go back to the mid 80s, Patrick Ewing going to the Knicks. Yeah. I mean, go way back when Connie Mack blowing up his Philadelphia A's teams on a number of occasions when they were really, so, I mean, this is nothing new. I think that what's different in this case, and I think what's going to be fascinating here is, you know, Brian Flores, what the accusations are in this suit are potentially different from what he can prove. So I'm going to be fascinated to see know, is there some documentation of some sort?
Hugh Jackson already started walking this back, right?
Right, exactly. And in the case of Hugh Jackson, you know, I mean, there's a lot of losing there and you know, lots of missteps on his part that, you know, I think you look at that whole dynamic. Yeah, they were trying to lose. Yeah, they were rebuilding. You know, rebuilding in and of itself is, you know, and you get into the ethical part of this.
Hey, by the way, it's what you're here, right? Like, I'm sitting in front of Joe Burrow, right, before they put the sign up.
Well, and that's the thing.
I'm sitting in front of Sports Grid, but I was sitting in front of Joe Burrow. They made him disappear.
I mean, but that's the thing, though. There are the right decision at times when you are talking about teams in any sport. There are times when the right decision is to take a step back before you can move forward again. So now that said, when you get into a case where a former head coach of an NFL team is accusing and saying that the owner of the team offered him essentially $100,000 bonus for each loss, that is a very different dynamic. You know, it's one thing to talk about a team tanking or rebuilding. It's another thing when there are incentives in place going beyond a draft pick or even beyond saving some money on payroll from a business sense. But when you're actually incentivizing individuals by giving them cash bonuses, that is, I mean, you know, again, there's ethical discussions to be had about tanking. But when you're talking about something that's so overt and saying, I am literally going to pay you more money to lose, then that is, to me, that is a very different dynamic, especially, as you mentioned, on the heels of the league getting into bed with gambling to the degree that they have over the last couple of years and will continue to. Boy, you want to talk about something completely problematic. I'm going to be fascinated to see what Flores and his legal team, you know, what more they have on that in terms of evidence and, you know, if there truly is any form of documentation saying, yeah, you know, this is, you know, not that it's going to be written in his contract per se, but if there's some, you know, some smoking gun that proves that was definitely happening. I can't even imagine what the ramifications could be for that. And I would certainly think you would be talking about a case where you know, losing a franchise and deservedly so in that case, you know, for Stephen Ross.
Well, Chris, we can speak to integrity because, I mean, look at the Washington football team last week, right? I mean, they finally get around to releasing everything. And, I mean, that's at the heart of all of this in the congressional hearings. And, you know, I was following Andrew Brandt and others the other day in Congress. The fact that the government's getting involved in this now and that Dan Snyder's got a new name. And I guess, you know, whatever the fanfare they were looking for there on the inside of that, that sort of went away as well. We really are speaking to, and I know we began last segment talking about Dick Cass and Steve Bisciotti and the future of the Ravens. Who owns these teams and what are they doing? You know what I mean? Like, literally, what are these people doing at the top of this pyramid to put Roger Goodell in this position and then have the league sending out without merits and getting the Giants involved and John Elway drunken at interviews and just it's pretty unseemly all the way around, is it not, Chris?
It is, and I want to tie up to Luke's points. I mean, this is, you know, we talk about the fact that Sean Payton had to sit for a year because of Bounty Gate.
By the way, he threw a hell of a party for the media down there. I saw that.
Yes, he did. Yes,
Harbaugh's not going to throw a party for that like that for me and Luke. I tell you what.
I know, but this is a different Bounty Gate. And the league has to look at this Bounty Gate as hard as they did with the Saints and their head coach. But I think the final point is, and I think Andrew Brandt may have said this and others have said this, the league never lets any lawsuit ever get the discovery. There's been several lawsuits against the league, and suddenly, just before they get the discovery, the opportunity to open the emails and open the information, suddenly those lawsuits go away. And that's been the league's strategy. They'll take the PR hit in the short term. You know, they set it up in Washington where, you know, they can't release any information from the investigation without Dan Snyder's tacit approval. Okay. Everyone knows.
I bet the government's going to have something to say about that.
Well, they will, but they won't. They'll have other things that they'll be dealing with here before short order, and it will get shuffled to the back. It was an opportunity for them to talk about it in the short term. And it's another sort of league thing. But, you know, the bottom line is Roger Goodell is like any other commissioner in pro sports. You're taking the bullet for the billionaires behind you who own the money and are paying you. You are taking the bullets on their behalf. So if Roger Goodell is a pinata again at the news conference this week in LA, like he's been several times here in the last few years, Roger's making north of $20 million a year to be that pinata for the owners, okay? And to say the right things and to say whatever it is the NFL wants to say when they finally got around to sending a letter to the clubs about the Flores lawsuit and the allegations of tanking in Miami. A very different letter that went out to club presidents and was conveniently leaked to media sources, okay? This is a much different NFL response than the original one, the without merit response that everyone seems to be, you know, kind of hammering them about. And so it's an opportunity. That letter gives Goodell a chance to stand up there. And Nestor and Luke, you've been around our good friend Kevin Byrne for many, many years. And one of his things he always talked about was mantra. And so Goodell can go up with the mantra of this letter and keep repeating it until people leave him alone about the original statement about the without merit. Okay, so he has some cover, and they've got something they can stand on and move forward from, and try to get the media to go squirrel. Look over there; it's another thing that's going on.
Maybe
he'll
be drinking cocoa with Eric Bieniemy on draft night.
Right, exactly. Right, you know? And so you know that's what the league is trying to do here with the letter that they sent out and knew it would get out, and the Washington situation, everything else. At the end of the day, they're going to protect the owners. There are certain owners that are being protected. That are, you know, I mean, Jerry Jones is very tight with Stan Kroenke, and there were reports that he was defending Kroenke in terms of the other owners, not happy with them about the lawsuit that was finally settled with St. Louis. You know, he's very tight with Dan Snyder.
They're still sure who's going to pay St. Louis. St. Louis is getting $900 million. The lawyers are getting $300 million.
But Jerry Jones was the one trying to stand in the breach, going, no, you can't do this to my business partner, you know, Kroenke, because – you know, out of the stadium at SoFi, he's got a piece of that. So these guys don't get into that room without being incredibly smart and have incredibly smart people around them, from lawyers to business people, CEOs, presidents, whatever you want to call it. You don't get to this point as an owner of the National Football League without a pretty good knowledge of what things are and how things are. And, you know, Roger Goodell is going to stand up there. And like I said, he's going to take those bullets on behalf of Dan Snyder. He's going to take bullets on behalf of Stan Kroenke. He's going to take bullets on behalf of Stephen Ross in Miami. It'll be fun to watch from a PR standpoint, because, you know, that's good theater and good television. But
send the questions along. I got nothing to do on Friday. I'll come over.
Right. But eventually, all of those answers and questions and answers will all be lost by the time we get to Sunday at 6:40 and we kick off Super Bowl 56 and we're talking about football and Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth are talking, you know, the two teams on the field, which is what the league is hoping to get to. They just got to get to Sunday.
Luke, I know you got more. Luke Jones is here. Chris Pike is here. We usually do this all together on Radio Row. We're breaking tradition. I'm wearing my Maryland Lottery mask. We're letting ourselves play. I've got koozies and hats and shirts for all of our sponsors. Big appreciation, everybody making this happen. Luke is back because he didn't want to wear a mask and sound stupid like this all week. Right? Exactly, right? True?
Not gonna lie. That was probably part of it. Yeah, sure.
I'm going to tell you, dude, it's 82 outside. Outside it's 82. But you know, for you with this and coming here and being a part of this conversation all week, I am interested to see who's going to wind up sitting here. And you both have been a part of this for a very, very long time. I think this week, because of celebrities, LA, the distance, by the way, they finally got tables far enough away that I can't offend anybody. So it's, there's a lot of space here. They doubled the tables. There's two tables. Everybody has two, so that they're wider. So if I have three guests here, I could sort of spread everybody out, which I'll probably do anyway, as we get this thing going. But Luke, for the league this week, and we have Dick Cass this week, and Steve Bisciotti's absent. That's going to be my theme when I, where's Steve? And I asked DaCosta about that. And I know You and I could probably do five more segments on Eric DaCosta, and we will, in his statements on Friday. But sort of felt like the Ravens wrung everything out last week, right? And then they news dumped this Dick Cass thing. And usually you and I are sitting here doing 60 hours a week of, hey, how about that Joe Burrow? And how about that Matt Stafford? And how about that Aaron Donald? And how about these young coaches? And look at these franchises. And look at all the cool stories like Andrew Whitworth. Is there a better story ever than Eric Weddle, right, this week? But, you know, I think we're going to be on to other things, certainly you and me, with the Ravens and DaCosta and Dick Cass and where the owner is, because he used to speak this time this week. And then there's just all these other sidelights. I don't want to say the game takes a back seat, but it's not what's on my mind today. That's for sure.
Well, I think as we get closer to kickoff on Sunday, I think that changes a little bit. I think it's interesting. All the issues we've talked about, we haven't even mentioned, oh yeah, Tom Brady announced his retirement. How about that? The number of Super Bowls you and I've been to where Tom Brady's been up on that wall. I mean, that's not lost on this. But yeah, I mean, for the Ravens specifically, yeah, it was kind of a very busy week, you know, where you hear head coach, you hear the new defensive coordinator, you hear from the general manager. As you pointed out, no Steve Bisciotti, which, you know, we're now going on 4 years since he's taken questions from the local media. He has done some, I think he did one or two Q&As with, you know, some of the conference calls with season ticket holders over the last 4 years. But, you know, it's speaking as, you know, a member of the media, but also I think someone who can still view it as a fan. It's disappointing not to hear from him every year anymore. You know, I mean, that was not something that other owners did around the league, but to go from one, you know, one extreme to now, well, on the other side where we're not hearing from him at all, it is interesting, especially with the backdrop of Dick Cass retiring. And
it Sasha tells me he's closer to the end than the beginning.
Yeah.
All of this does.
Sure. And I would even say, well, also, when you've been an owner for 18 years, generally speaking, you are going to be closer to the end in most instances.
They all have an exit strategy, right? You got to have that, right? Even if it's Mr. Benchin's exit strategy, which is I'm going to exit with the franchise. They all have an exit strategy, right?
They do. I mean, Mrs. Benson does not have children, does not have a husband. She is going to sell the team. The team is going to be sold after her death. And the proceeds, basically whatever they make off it, will go to charities in the New Orleans area. She announced that about 4 or 5 months ago in order, you know, I think there was something that she wanted to do because she does not have any heirs. And that's so every owner has to have a strategy. Denver's strategy was a little bit more convoluted because of the amount of family. And so now that team is going to go up for auction. And it's going to be worth somewhere north of $4 billion by reports.
Be careful. Last time a baseball team auctioned in Baltimore, we got screwed.
I'd be interested to see what Steve will do, you know, down the line. I mean, you know, you've got people, obviously, you know, you talk about owners that speak and don't speak, Dallas and Jerry Jones. This is a guy who speaks and has his own show on TV every Saturday night during the football season. You know, he's as accessible as any
Jim
owner.
Jim Irsay's got music and Twitter.
Right. And you have guys that do all that. So it is different, especially because Steve was, I wouldn't say, you know, he wasn't overly out there, but he was available to the local media. He was available to fans. He was someone that you saw and you knew he was there.
I thought it was appropriate. I thought he, if I look back, if he sells a team tomorrow, I'd say he was appropriately visible until the end and he didn't want to be involved anymore. And my vibe is he doesn't want to get up there and have me ask him questions about selling the team right now. I don't think he wants to answer those. I think we've seen the last of Steve, you know, in that way. I don't think Steve will ever do that again. And the next time you'll hear from Steve like that, other than giving money or, oh, I don't know, hiring an African-American team president at 6 o'clock on a Friday night when the whole league is buzzing about African-American coaches not being given opportunities. And then he's not even out on front of it to like stand up and be front facing. It blows my mind, Chris. I thought the Friday thing was really bizarre. I mean, a lot of it's bizarre. And I tell you what, if next week, 3 days after the Super Bowl, the franchise is sold to some billionaire, it wouldn't shock me. I'm just saying, like, all of this has been orchestrated. It's exit strategy. It's what a guy who is a billionaire who built personnel. This is what you do when you're getting toward the end. And so, and if we're not, then he should stand up and say he's not selling the team. but I think he is. That's my opinion. It's not a fact. It's an opinion, because these are the clues of what happens when you're setting up a team to not be involved in it anymore.
Well, you're also looking at timeline here, and the Ravens were up against the timeline on Friday because the league really doesn't want any club news coming out this week to go up against Super Bowl week. So I don't know, you know, what the timeline was with Sashi Brown and the Wizards and the Leonsis group as far as the timing of that announcement and the timing of his announcement with the Ravens. So, yes, it was bizarre in that way. I have to think that sometime in March, when Sashi Brown gets ready to take the reins as club president, there will be some sort of press conference with him, Steve, and Dick Cass, if nothing else, to celebrate Dick's time with the team and send him off in the proper way prior to sort of everybody getting ready for the draft and sending him out in that way. I would be shocked if the Ravens didn't do something like that, that was a little bit more formal or put together, that Steve could give his appreciation to Dick in a public forum and also talk about the person who's going to be taking over, you know, where you'd have Harbaugh and DaCosta there and all of that to welcome
him. By the way, I would be shocked if Dick didn't pick Sashi Brown. I don't know anything about that. We're 48 hours on. I'm sitting out in Los Angeles. It feels to me like Dick may have picked the successor, because Steve sent Dick to owners' meetings to represent him, and Steve just stopped going because he didn't feel like he was relevant, and he felt like Dick knew all of the information better than Steve did. And that's from Steve's lip. I mean, that's a fact. That's not an opinion. I know that to be true. And, you know, there's a part of that where Dick really ran the team, like in a more than people know. And that's why it was kind of shocking to me. And Luke knows that because he's in the building out there. Luke knows that because he talks to the employees out there, that Dick was hands-on and in there. Dick was the eyes, ears, and actor of the owner in a way that's very unusual, as you pointed out, in some buildings where you really do get that the ability to do that. But so much so that the owner backed off and just said, "You're better at it than I would ever be," which is such a Steve thing to say. But this is fascinating. That if he were to show up in a couple of weeks and talk about this, I would be shocked by that. I would be pleasantly surprised, but I would be shocked. Luke, you think you're going to be asking Steve Bisciotti questions in the next couple of weeks?
I mean, I think what Chris just laid out makes perfect sense, but based on, you know, what we've said, we haven't, you know, he's been pretty scarce as it relates to being in front of the media over the last 4 years answering questions. I mean, one thing I want to throw out there as far as ownership, let's keep in mind, 30-year lease expires after the 2027 season. Not talking in terms of, you know, the franchise in Baltimore being in jeopardy, but might that be part of the timeline at work here? Not that it's going to be Steve Bisciotti's owner until then, but, you know, they made their, what, $140 million in renovations? What was that, 3 or 4 years ago? They had the three-year
project. By the way,
project.
I don't know if the team's worth more with a 30-year lease or less. My gut would be, to an owner, it might be worth less if it's stuck in Baltimore. And I'm not saying, I don't think there's any thought that the Ravens, right, they got to deal with the Chargers and the Jaguars and these other lousy teams first. But I don't know if it ups the value or lowers it, probably based on the terms of the lease. If you got a beautiful lease,
sure,
an owner would like it more, I guess.
Well, I would say if you're talking in terms of Steve Bisciotti caring about this community, caring about Baltimore, caring about the Baltimore Ravens and their future, might that be the final objective for him before he then pulls the trigger?
By the way, as I sit in
the
middle of Los Angeles, where a guy from Missouri moved the team from St. Louis here.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, but I'm saying that might be, and look, if there's a 20-year lease that's struck in the next couple of years and extends it out, it's not as though the value of the franchise goes in the tank. Now, it does impact it. I agree with you on that. So might that be something where Steve Bisciotti views himself as a steward for the organization and wanting to do right by the community to say, this is the last major objective on my docket before I then look to sell. I don't know that. I haven't heard that from anyone, but to me, that's kind of the one natural thing left here with knowing now that Dick Cass is moving on, that perhaps that's maybe the last thing on the agenda for Steve, if in fact he is looking to sell here in the near future.
I would say this, knowing Steve a little bit and having had privy to very private conversations, I think it's extremely important to him and his legacy that he is never perceived as being a bad guy. And I think he saw what happened to Art's legacy being trampled upon, and others, and what's going on with Dan Snyder and other, you know, people that will never get their reputation back. Steve would never, that would be really devastating for Steve. Steve would not want to be perceived, quite frankly, as an asshole. He just wouldn't. He it's really important to him, as much as he's not out in front of all of this, that he isn't buried as the guy who sold the team off to the gypsies that moved the Ravens to, I don't, Bemidji. I mean, I'm making that up, but I think you're right. It's really important to Steve. So the team staying in Baltimore would be paramount for Steve to sell it. I think that would be the first question at the press conference, and that'd be the first thing that I'm sure he feels like he would sew up. So I do feel confident about that, but I do feel like, and I had a dear friend of me say this is the end of an era a month or two ago, sort of letting me know on the inside that maybe this is happening. It's to your point, Chris, Dick Cass is 76 years old, right? I mean, it's not shocking that it happened or the way it happened. And I'm just spitballing and saying he probably is the one that picked Sashi Brown. We'll find all that out. Good reporters will find that stuff out. But this is – things are going to change here. And I guess that's just my point in all of this is we are going into a different era.
We are, and I think to the three points. One, Dick Cass helped give Sashi one of his first jobs, I think, at his law firm in D.C., and helped advance him to the Jaguars before he went to the Browns. I think he tried to help him so that there is a relationship there. To two of Luke's points, any renewal of a lease will never be as long as the original, especially as facilities age. And I know some owners, potential owners, may look at a long lease. You know, if that lease is half of the original lease where it's 15 years, because you start getting the age issues and what they want to do. I think that's part of it. But I think something that both of you touched on that I'll be very interested in. Steve Bisciotti, by your reporting, Nestor and Luke, has not been as visible at the owners' meetings. Dick Cass has been that person over the last several years on behalf of the club. And has
been well, you know, they have a thing there, and I've been privy to all of this. It's called a one-in or a two-in.
Right.
One-in is one representative for the franchise. Right. In 28 of the 32 cases, maybe 31 of 30, right. It's the owner or a relative of the owner.
Right. And so you have Dick Cass in that role. So now, to this point, you have Sashi Brown, who was around the league for a very long time. But now Steve is going to have to get back in that pool, if you will, of league issues. Obviously, he's made aware of everything by Dick Cass on a daily basis or whatever he needs to know. But now Steve has to be visible again in those meetings and be that person in the short
term. Steve has no interest in doing that, dude.
He's
a billionaire. He's not going to do that.
Right, but when you go from Dick Cass to Sashi Brown in the interim, and I'm talking maybe a year, okay, there is a change, and there's going to be a change for owners in the room and information. And obviously, Dick knows exactly what Steve Bisciotti wants in terms of votes, in terms of information, what he needs to know, what Dick may talk about in that room with those owners on behalf of Steve Bisciotti. So there's going to be a learning curve for Sashi Brown, as it would be for anybody in a new job. And so Steve, just by that alone, would have to be a little bit more involved in the short term until Sashi gets up to speed with how the Ravens do business and how Steve wants things to be done. So I think there may be maybe a little bit more visibility to Steve in the short term just because of situation. I don't think it's a long-term thing. But you wouldn't expect Sashi Brown to be able to walk in there and do it exactly as Dick Cass has done over the last several years on his behalf.
I'm out in L.A. It is Super Bowl 56 coverage from the Los Angeles Convention Center. I've got the hats and koozies and lottery stuff and Chaucer. Come get naughty at the Chaucer. We're going to be getting the crab cake tour going at Nacho Mama's on March the 4th. Luke, I'm just, you know, so what have we learned here? I guess we'll get together again a couple of times during the week. You know, it's going to be a little crazier, I think, crazier toward the end of the week. And you and I could go at great lengths, and we will, about Eric DaCosta's press conference and John Harbaugh last week and the new defensive coordinator. There's just a lot going on, man, and I don't know how you put a bow on it. We got a pretty decent football game here and a big story in L.A. and all these other sidelights of Eric Weddle's and Joe Burrow's and all those and who's getting hired. Boy, we're not lacking for things to talk. I miss you guys, man. I wish we were going out for some Korean barbecue tonight, man.
That sounds like that'd be great. But yeah, I mean, there's plenty going on. And you mentioned Joe Burrow. I mean, how about let's give Matthew Stafford an applause after being a loser in Detroit for so long. And so, you know, can't win playoff games and, you know, just being tied to that franchise. And, you know, he was a good soldier there for a long time, good quarterback. But, you know, at some point in time, you do ask that question as far as is how much of it's the Lions and how much of it's him, and for him to go. And it's not as though he's been all world invincible as a quarterback, but you know, for him at his age, at this stage of his career, to be on this stage for the first time. And, you know, looking at it from a Ravens perspective, wondering if this is going to be the first of multiple appearances for Joe Burrow. And you look at where the Bengals are positioned cap wise and resource wise moving forward, you know, they're going to be better. You know, they have the chance to be better in the next couple of years even. But, you know, Stafford, I mean, I think that's a cool story. I mean, you mentioned Eric Weddle. I mean, that's something out of a movie. That's how weird that is. You know, that he went from being at home and then he's starting the NFC Championship and leading his team in tackles. I mean, played every snap. Just, you know, kind of a wild story. So, you know,
going to Disneyland for ice cream.
That's a lot of ice cream.
I won't feel bad about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sure.
I don't care who wins. It'll be good. It'll be good either way for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I mean, after so many years of Tom Brady, you know, it's different now. And now you do still have an elder statesman kind of quarterback in Stafford who hasn't had nearly the acclaim or accolades, but he's got a chance. And now you have, you know, we've talked about the last few years, these second-year quarterbacks. You had Mahomes win the MVP. You had Lamar Jackson win the MVP in his second year. Burrow didn't win the MVP, but lo and behold, he's got a chance to win a Super Bowl. I mean, I think it's just a reminder that as much as we've just spent a couple hours, you know, over a few segments talking about some of these league-wide issues that are very serious in nature, especially with the Brian Flores suit and diversity concerns. As far as the play on the field, the game's in good hands. When you look at quarterbacks like Joe Burrow, and you know, that just makes it fun. And you know, as I've said from a Ravens perspective, or you look at the Bengals, if they win, hey, that just puts more heat on the Ravens to step it up. That puts more heat on the Browns to step it up and figure out, you know, their situation with Baker Mayfield. And the Steelers, they've got a good roster, but what the heck are they going to do at quarterback?
I don't know how they're going to draft all three of those quarterbacks down at the Senior Bowl with that one pick. I don't know how they're going to do that.
Exactly. So,
by the way, Senior Bowl happened last week. We didn't even talk about the Senior Bowl.
Yeah. Well, and we didn't talk about the Pro Bowl, thank God.
Chris, you got anything you want to say about the Pro Bowl? That Justin Tucker, he can kick it, huh? He's the GOAT, huh?
I watched 30 seconds of it.
Terrible.
You know, I mean, let's put it this way. I watched more of the NHL All-Star game the day before than I did the Pro Bowl. You know, and that's just as much scoring. There's as little, right, little or no defense in that game.
So you know? Chris, let's cut to the chase here. We're in L.A. this year. We're next year, Arizona, right? Arizona?
I think that's right, yep.
And then Vegas after that, right? Is New Orleans getting it back?
They'll be back in New Orleans here in a few years.
All right. So what I want to do is just make a little blood brother pact here that this is the last time I have to sit here and do this alone on the Zoom where I'm wearing a mask and I'm having Korean barbecue and you guys are back in the cold. It's 82 here, Luke. 82 outside.
Well, it's 28 here. So there you go.
It's in the 60s in here. It's nice. It's nice. I hope to convene with both of you later on in the week. I hope that I'm too busy to even bother, right? I mean, we hope it's crazier. I have no idea what to expect. But I have a mask on, and I'm out here in L.A., and we're doing our thing. I am Nestor on behalf of my dear friends, Chris Pike at Blog and Tackle and Luke Jones. Chris, because I can't take you for proper Takei Chan for proper Korean chicken, you want to stay fair, right? You want to give a little plug out there?
I went over to State Fair this afternoon. The great folks over in Catonsville after watching Mount St. Joe and at St. Francis tangling basketball over in Irvington. We made the ride over there and had a great lunch. They were slammed and busy and a lot of great food. They just changed up their menu here recently. So it was a nice afternoon, and the good folks at State Fair do it right.
I had the best breakfast of the year thus far. We're only 5 weeks into the year, and I'm in L.A. It's going to be pretty tough this week. El Guapo. I had the steak and eggs and potatoes. Oh, my God. It was so good. It was carne asada. Delicious. Get on out to all of our sponsors. I'll be plugging them all week long. Luke will be around. He'll be out at BaltimorePositive.com back at the homestead. And I'm here in Los Angeles. I'll get my sunglasses out and hanging out. All brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play on March 4th as we kick off the Crab Cake Tour. But for now, it's sushi. I may put blonde tips back in my hair. Go surfing. It's 82 degrees. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, broadcasting live from Radio Row in Los Angeles. Maybe I can get the Van Earl Wright to stop by. That'd be kind of fun. Back for more right after this from LA.